Blog Talk Radio. Everyone, and welcome to Spirit Travels Radio. I'm Karen Miles, and this is my co-host, Jolene Bratson. Good evening, Jolene. How are you doing?
Good evening. I'm doing fair. Thank you. Happy birthday.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's going to be a great day indeed. I wanted to kind of jump into to our special guest today. We have Jay Tavaray. Jay's various projects are gaining more noticeable every day, and he's receiving many requests for interviews. He's an actor and writer. He's known around the world for his roles in Pathfinder, The Missing, Cold Mountain, Into the West, and Adaption, just to name a few. He is author of numerous screenplays, magazine articles, and an ongoing blog on the Huffington Post, aside from his work in film. Jay's passion is humanitarian work. For the last 10 years, he has been a celebrity spokesperson for Adopt a Native Elder program. He also works with the youth of the Mescalero Apache Reservation in support of their prevention program, Honor Your Life. Recently, Jay has launched his own production company, Apache Dragon Productions, and is currently hard at work on his innovation music project, Tears of a Shaman. Today, Jay joins us to talk about all his work and everything that he holds dearly to him. Hello, Jay. How are you today?
Hi, everyone. I feel great. It's a rainy day here in L.A., but it's all sunny inside.
Well, I know that we've been trying to get this show together for at least three months now, so I am thrilled to be able to do this today, and it's such an honor to have you on the show with us.
Well, thank you. The honor is mine. Anytime I can, share what I'm doing with the world, with anybody out there who can listen and spread the light and the good vibe, I'm ready.
Well, that's fabulous. I know that you have been doing quite a bit of stuff. I wanted to take the time to ask you about you. So if you don't mind, tell everybody a little bit about yourself, and then we'll go from there and just kind of chat and have a good time.
Sure. Where do I start? Well, I've been in Hollywood now for quite a few decades. And, my life really started ever since I remember. I was adopted when I was a very, very young age, and I ended up in a European boarding school, and I spent most of my youth all over Europe, and that's how I got involved in music and dance. That was my first introduction to entertainment. That led me to television commercials. Eventually, I took the whole acting thing seriously when I made my way back to Los Angeles in mid-1980s. And, I always say, to be successful in this business is a combination of persistence and luck, much more important than talent or looks. And I was persistent enough, and I got lucky. And in 1994, I did my first film, Street Fighter, with Jean-Claude Van Damme and Raul Julia, where I played Vega. And a lot of the kids remember me from that, the mask Matador.
Mm-hmm.
And that really was, like 18 years ago, and that, snowballed me into where I am today. But the role that really got me noticed in Hollywood was when I worked with Meryl Streep and Nicolas Cage and Chris Cooper in a wonderful movie called Adaptation, which was written by Charlie Kaufman, and he went to win, you know, was nominated for several Oscars and won the Oscar for Chris Cooper.
Yes.
And that, you know, that 1 minute or so on screen with Meryl Streep was what I needed to open up the doors, which is the ironic part of our business. You can be in the business for 10 years and nobody knows you, but you play one little role in the right movie at the right time, and the next day everybody wants you for their films. And, then I worked up with Anthony Minghella in Cold Mountain, where I played Jude Law's Cherokee brother, with Nicole Kidman and Renée Zellweger, and I got cast by Ron Howard in a wonderful movie called The Missing.
Yeah.
And he didn't even audition me for that one. He literally had seen my work and offered me the role of Keita, which was the Apache father medicine man. And, in that period, I've also, my passion is, I'm a storyteller. That's how I see myself. And I try to express myself in as many forms as I can find, whether it's music, or writing, or acting. I feel like life is all about reflection of what we see, and you put out there what's in your heart anyway. So, it's a way of moving people for me, and that's what excites me. If I can excite my audience or inspire them, that gives me the vibration I need. It's, you know, people say it's an ego thing, but it really is not. I mean, I get just as much pleasure reading my critics as I do my fans. Because, you know, sometimes you actually learn more from your critics than you do from your fans. And, it's been a wonderful journey so far. And I feel like it's really only the beginning. You know, in the last 3 years, I've been writing for Huffington Post, where I share of my travels and my work, not just with the Indian nations, but wherever I can go. And I'm open to all kinds of abilities. Like earlier this year, BBC America approached me to get this wonderful show they have called No Kitchen Required on the Apache Reservation, and they're having a little bit of difficulty doing that. And I, you know, with my relationships that I have with some of the elders and the youth on the reservation and the work I've been doing for the last decade or so, I was able to get the show on the reservation, and it just made me really excited and happy to see so many Apaches hired and paid.
Good.
Being a wonderful show. It's an international show, and it's a hit show. I mean, last night was the second episode where they went to New Zealand with the Maori tribe, and the premise of the show is three master chefs. They travel the world to 10 exotic locations for the first season. They meet the indigenous people. They must then, first, they have a meet and greet party where they learn as much as they can from the culture. Then they have to go out, hunt, and prepare meals from what they've learned or inspired by what they've learned, and then to come back and get judged by the tribal elders. And I was actually one of the judges on the Apache Res with Debbie Naichi Martinez, who is the great-great-granddaughter of Cochise, and her two daughters. So it's a tremendous honor for me.
Wow.
Before you started into the movies, what was your inspiration, or was it just, it kind of led up to that, that was your path that you were going, or were you discovered?
Well, no, it was, ever since I was a young man or boy, whatever you want to call it, I feel like I was always a man because I didn't really grow up with my parents, so even before I was about 10, I knew a sense of responsibility where I was on my own. And that feeling of being alone made me grow up really quick. And but to fit in, I always found that I had to, fit in with the locals. Like when I was in Europe, I was mistaken by many different people. You know, in fact, you know, there's my so-called naysayers have found this clip that I put out actually on YouTube of me winning the World Freestyle Breakdance Championships. All the way back in 1983, where I was a youth, and I won the title for Italy. So, for whatever reason, suddenly I'm Italian because I won that competition. But the truth is, I won the Italian segment of the contest, and since I lived in Europe and my adopted parents, one half was Italian, Anglo-Italians, in fact, and Jewish. Go figure that one out. managed to represent Italy. It's just like Kobe Bryant played for Italy. Basketball did not make him Italian either. So, but I've led a very unusual life. I mean, because I kind of like, you know, even as a young man, I realized when I was in Spain, the Gitanos and the Gypsies saw me as one of them. When I was in Italy, people saw me as one of them. When I was, in South America, people saw me as one of them. And I realized that ability to morph, change was just natural to me. I would even sound like the locals. You know, people who see interviews of me from 1980s go, "Oh my God, your voice, you sound different." I go, "But that's just part of my shape-shifting ability I always had, where I molded and mimicked the people I was with." And, you know, I get accused a lot, "Well, he's not a Native American," which is, I don't know what that means nowadays anyway. You know I'm an Indian in my heart, and I know I have bloodlines. I have even my DNA done where I have that one Mongolian gene that goes all the way to the Gobi Desert that every American Indian possesses. So I'm an indigenous man, I know that. And I was readopted by the Apaches and the Navajos after the work I did with them. In the last 25 years, I've gone through ceremonies and I've, you know, lived my life walking the red roads. But I don't really go out nowadays and claim anything. I just, it's about, you know, being a human being. And I guess you ask where I was spotted or discovered. Well, I guess dancing would be the answer to that, because I was a great dancer. I was an exciting dancer. I would combine tribal moves with break dancing and acrobatic moves. And, you know, and when I won the world title, that was my first introduction to the big stage, which was the world. And this was a big event. It was a $110,000, you know, gift purse at the end of the contest, a car, a scholarship. So that particular year, over 500,000 finalists from 40 different nations entered that contest to win that title. And it was in 1983, end of it, December 83. So there was a tremendous amount of attention on the person who won it. And that kind of like catapulted me into the show business. And I've never stopped since. You know, I got the bug, and I've never really done a 9-to-5 job. I mean, that's the reality of my life. I've led an unusual, blessed life. And I've lived without fear. You know, there's been times that I have been broke, and there's been times that I've made, you know, 6 years. But the point is, I always lived with faith in my heart and just followed my passion and just saw what happened, you know, what the doors open. You know, sometimes people look back and go, "Wow, I love the movies you picked and the roles you did." So really, at the beginning of your career, the movies and the roles pick you.
Right.
You know, so... As much as I like to say, "Well, yeah, I wanted to be in this movie." Well, of course you want to be in that movie, but the truth is, they have to choose you. And
right.
any of these roles that I've landed, every other Native actor or actors in general were up for it. So nothing was handed to me. I had to work hard, stay focused, and I got lucky. And but I also had a little bout with music after my dance, and that, you know, I was involved with several bands in Europe. One was called the Wild Nation. Another one was called Street Life. And we had a series of hit records where we traveled through Europe in Holland and Germany, which is the biggest recording circuit in Europe. So all of that kind of introduced me to being on stage, being in front of people, making music videos, and I could see the excitement and the enjoyment I got from that. And so I guess acting was just the next step. You know, but it was a long, long dream, that, and it took, you know, a decade or so to fulfill that. But and here I am today. But you know, like I said, there's never a place where you say, "Okay, now I'm there." It's a constant evolution, and that's the part of the business I really enjoy, which is, you know, acting is like an exercise for your spirit, for your soul. You get to walk so many different lives and so many different paths, and that to me, I mean, I used to get bored quickly, and I still do in some ways, so I need to constantly keep that adrenaline excitement level in my life where I'm moving and shifting and feel like I'm accomplishing things. That's the only way I feel like I'm being useful. Sitting
right.
around, it's just really this pillar for me.
Right.
Well, I noticed it too, that you do a lot with Adopt an Elder Foundation, and then No Kitchen Required. So in all reality, with all of your success, you do give back to the public. And would you mind telling us some of the work that you've done with those programs?
Yes. Like many celebrities, when I wanted to be involved with the charity, I didn't want to just lend my name or be the poster boy or stand with a bunch of dogs and say, here, I'm doing this charity or whatever. I actually physically wanted to be involved. And I did my research back in 2002, and I found a wonderful program called Adopt a Native Elder Program. And two women who had started this program 20 years ago with Linda Myers and Grace Smith Yellowhammer. And these one was a Navajo, one was a lady.
Yes.
And the two of them, incredible spirit. I mean, Linda is an incredibly unique individual who was so brave, who started this program by just literally walking into a Navajo reservation at the height of the conflict that they're having with the Hopis and try to help the Navajos, because many Navajos got displaced when the Hopi reservation by the government landed right in the middle of the Navajo land. You know, typical. You know, they put one reservation right in the middle of another reservation,
right,
knowing that there was going to be problems. And
right.
So she walked into the restaurant, changed that, and 20 years later, from her one time, she has now a program that, you know, helps over 500 elders. And we have food and medicine runs twice a year where we take baskets and parcels of food, flour, medicine, everything to be able to allow the elders to sustain their way of life. I mean, many of these elders live traditionally in Hogan on dirt floors with no running water, no electricity. It's actually shocking to us to know that when the winter sets in, many of them cannot even leave the area they're in. So we just try to provide them with the necessities to survive the winters. And every year they have an annual rug show, which is usually in November. This year will be at the end of October in Park City, Utah. It's entirely run by volunteers. And all the proceedings goes back to the weavers and the jewelry makers and the Navajos. So there's no commissioning at all. And it's an amazing program. I mean, last year, because of all the radio shows and interviews I've done, I had over 25 people from all over the world who flew in to sponsor this time. And that was so powerful and moving. And these people are known as spirit volunteers. And I have my own program that's called Warming Hearts, which I constantly beg people to help out, because the Adopt a Native Elder's Wood program, firewood program, only accepts $100 donations, which is about 1 month of firewood for the elders. But I came to the program where I realized, because of the recession and where we are as a nation, any amount should be accepted. If someone can only give $5, they shouldn't be embarrassed that that's all they can give. It still is giving. And that's what I always encourage people, is the act of giving. Anything in life you want, you must give it away first. And it's a very scary thing when you have no money to think, okay, I have $10, how can I give $1 away? Well, how you can do that is because, you know, it's because whatever you put out, it multiplies the universal law and it comes back to you. Even the simple pebble that you drop, those rituals will come back like a tsunami. And that's like a very simple universal law, but very few people really get in touch with that. They'll just be like, well, that person can work, let him go work. But it's the idea of giving. I don't even think afterwards what that person might do in the street with the money you give them, whether they buy themselves a drink or whether they, you know, do something I don't approve of. That's their choice. For me, I gave from the kindness, from the willingness of my heart, and right there is where it ends. I don't expect anything back, because if you believe in the universal law, it will come back to you somewhere else. And I can tell all of your listeners, it does come back. I'm a living proof. Many times when I could not see the future, when I could not see around the bend, everything seemed dark, in the final moment, something would come to save me. You know, check that I wasn't expecting, a job that I didn't see coming, an opportunity that, you know, and I believe those become because of what I'm putting out there, the blessings that I get from my elders each year and the youth that I work with. So imagine if as a nation or as a global nation, we could all do practice that, what kind of a trickle-down effect that would have for the human race. I mean, it's It's what I love to spread, that type of love and hope in the world, because it's a really difficult time now for us as a race. And any time you can share or help, mm-hmm. I feel like you've done the right thing. And adopt a native elder, and I encourage all your listeners, if you want to learn more, just to go to www.anelder.org, A-N-E-L-D-E-R.org, and they have a comprehensive website, and my program, Warming Hearts, is under the wood firewood donation section. So you can learn how this program does reach so many people. And I encourage all of you, if you get a chance, come to the Rudd Show in October this year around Halloween. It's an amazing event. And all the people who are involved, they walk away enriched by the experience. They walk away, to see people from all over the world at this Rudd Show holding hands with the Navajo elders, and that made the journey, a little Italian lady from, Giovanna, coming all the way from Italy, and Rosita coming all the way from Holland, and I had people coming from Germany and Austria and Spain. It was just phenomenal, and that always puts that smile in my heart and in my face, to know that the little work I'm doing actually is making a difference.
That is wonderful.
Yeah.
It is. I can relate to that in many ways. I live in a community in Williamsburg, Virginia, and one day, it was inside my spirit, and I walked into an assisted living home that's across the highway from me. All elders, of course, live there. I looked for the events coordinator, and I handed her our business card, because I too am a storyteller, and my partner is my son's father, and he does artifacts. His name is Swamp Rat, and I handed her the card, and I said, if you can schedule a program, I would like to volunteer my time right here to what is called Colonial Manor. And she was so shocked that someone had walked in and said, I would like to give of my time to the elders. She did schedule a program, and we ended up staying there almost 3 hours. And
wow.
It was wonderful. And I walked away with knowing that my father, who passed away a year and a half ago, would have been very proud of me, but at the same time, I knew that inside of my spirit and my son and Swamp Rat, that this was what the calling was, because I would look at this building when I drove by every day, and I'd promise myself I was going to stop, and then that one day I stopped, and I have always smiled when I drove by, because this spring they plan on having us back, but outside, so that the elders can enjoy going outside. And my brother Red Hawk has done two movies, Shadow Hawk on Sacred Ground, and has made 7 CDs. And it's amazing, because when you talked about, not really having a 9-to-5 job, you're right, we don't. And it's a matter of where your soul takes you, and where fate leads you is where you are supposed to be.
Yeah, I agree. It's the mystery of life, the whole mystery of life is, there are some law, universal laws that are always at work. For example, the law of uncertainty. There's always an uncertain element about what is ahead. Many of us take that uncertainty and turn it into anxiety, when in fact you should turn that into an excitement for what is ahead, the challenges that are ahead. It really all comes down to perspective. I'm a huge believer of self-education. I feel like, just because you leave college or school doesn't mean you stop studying. You should always, life is a school. and you are preparing your spirit constantly, learning and evolving and reaching new heights and plateaus. And yes, sometimes you have to take a few steps back before you can take the next leap forward. And just the idea is not to live in fear, not to let fears hold you back. And I have a great saying I always use, that fear is really false evidence appearing real. And if you allow fear to hinder you, I mean, fear usually causes hesitation. And hesitation is time needed for all your fears to come true. So it's like, it's that faith in yourself, faith in what you're doing. And the way I work is, before I start any endeavor, I put a higher intention behind it. For example, my musical CD, Tears of the Shaman. I've been working on this for several years. When I came up with the conception, the idea was I saw this 2012 date approaching. I saw the world's fears. I actually blogged about this on Huffington Post. And I wanted to address it in a musical format, in a storytelling format, and that's what the album is. It's, you know, it tells the story of the Americas, but it's more than that, it tells the story of the human race. From the ancient migration, the children of the first man, the life givers, the women in our lives, you know. And the idea was to bring awareness, and if you make some money, at the heart of my CD, we're going to make a huge donation to the charities I'm involved with. And so, again, because I put that higher intention in there, I had no fear. I mean, there's been obstacles in the last 2 years, but I always overcome them, and we always pass them, and we get to the next stage, and something comes up. So that is the approach, Rudy, to have faith.
Amazing. It is amazing, and I'm just in awe of all the work that you do for the people, and how you have succeeded the way you have in all that you've done. I'm particularly wondering about Tears of a Shaman, as to when that album will be released, and can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure. Well, we have, I don't know, do you hear an echo? I hear an echo.
Yes, I hear an echo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a slight echo on this end. I may need to turn sound down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely planning for a release this year. That was the whole point of the album, was to be released in 2012. We are in the process of doing the final mix as we speak, and there will be a visual aspect to this CD, because the idea was to have a video clips that follows each track and tells the story, and it will potentially be a live show as well, and that's what we're all working on. And we don't really have any release date, but this will be both available hopefully as a CD and as downloads. And now we have some very, very interesting people involved. I mean, people like John Trudell allowed me to use some of their wonderful speeches for some of my tracks. I had drummers from the Navajo Nation, the White Lake drummers.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I had Apache medicine men giving me their healing chant that was part of their family for 100 years.
Yes.
Sacred songs that have never been allowed to be heard anywhere outside. They actually allowed me to use it in my album, because I told them it's a healing album. I'm trying to help the world heal things. So it's a completely unique project. And it's not, it was a Native American album. It really is not. I mean, it's got the American Indian influence in there, but it is really world music, and it is for the world. And anyone who's heard my album, they love it. I mean, it's different, it's unique. No two tracks are the same. You know, we have a variety of music and sounds in there. And my partner, Alexander von Bubenheim, who's an incredible composer. He was an Oscar-nominated composer for a movie called Das Experiment a few years back, and I was very fortunate to have him and find him. I worked with him a few years ago, and then I persuaded him what my concept was, and even the name, Tears of a Shaman. You know, people, think I don't understand. They go, well, Indians don't use the word shaman, which actually they do. In South America, many of the medicine men are known as shamans, or shamans. But I used it specifically for a reason, because I didn't want to call it Tears of a Medicine Man. The idea was a shaman is more of a global figure, and this is what I'm working towards now. I don't see, I don't see separation in people no longer, especially with the advent of Internet and Facebook. We now really see how small the world is. I mean, I have over 10,000 friends on Facebook, and I can tell you, I have people from all over the world. All over the world. Little countries that I don't even can pronounce their name, you know? Botswana and Turkey and like Yugoslavia and Japan and China and somewhere in Brazil in a little town, or whatever, and yet we can all communicate on this place called Facebook, you know? And when you see how small the world is, this global village, then you realize any knowledge that's now held by one people should help all of us. And that's what one of the things my elders have always said, try to, you know, for many years, the American Indians were closed to hearing. Because, and I understand why. There's a lot of charlatans out there who, like that guy James Ray, who did the Sweat Lodge and ended up killing people in Sedona inside the Sweat Lodge. And they abused the, you know, the whole spiritual aspect of certain cultures. But for me, it's all about, sharing and being honest and also healing this broken circle. I mean, there's no doubt the American Indians got a terrible deal in this equation when America was formed. You know, of all the nations, they got the worst deal of all. And you know, to this day, there's sovereign nations who live on these so-called reservations, which were basically prison camps. And at the time when these reservations were given out, they were the worst piece of land that nobody wanted. And it's ironic that now they found oil and gas underneath many of them, and it's worth a fortune. But
right.
You know, I know God has a sense of humor, you know, because... So, but ultimately, you know, I don't look at a white person now with hatred, because I say, well, look what you did to my ancestors or whatever, because that's not, it's no us and them in my eyes. Right now, we have to educate. We lost the gunfight. The only fight now is a spiritual war. And you don't go to fight with fists and bows and arrows. You go with a pen and your attorney nowadays. But the point is, you've got to educate people. You have to let people know what's going on. I always tell Americans, right now, this moment now, as you sit down and you're having a warm meal, there's some elder on a reservation, hungry, without food or water, you know, and yet we're sending money to all of these countries around the world that have earthquakes and problems. Our own indigenous people are suffering every single day. And that's not right. That is just not right. We cannot ignore a segment of American population. You know, Indians go to war for us. Indians stand up for many of our rights. They saved us during the Second World War with the Code Talkers. They are a strategic part of our country. And the knowledge that they hold is even more important than ever now for our survival, to the balance that we seek, because the chaos is upon us now. And unless you seek the balance in this chaos, we are lost, not just as a nation, but as a people. And it starts with having one, and I don't say go back to the old ways, because that's not going to work either. Change will be inevitable. It's already upon us. We have to now step forward with one foot into the future, but still maintaining the morality and the teachings of the elders. And that's why I always look at elders as these gems, because they really are gems. You know, yeah. In the Western culture, when someone gets old, we put them into a nursing home and we don't want to talk about it. But to the Indians, we protect the elders. They are gems that have to be, you know, and you treasure them, and we learn, and they live among us. We don't put them away and hide them.
Oh.
So that's, you know, all of that, I think, is worth sharing and talking about, because I believe this generation of crystal children, kids who are born after the year 2000, they are ready. They're not like their parents or grandparents. These kids will accept the reality of what happened. They will not hate because of the color of their skin. They will not be prejudiced to open ideas and talking about the spirit world, going, oh, is that Indian mumbo-jumbo? No. Science has not proven, you know. All through our planet, there are these tiny particles that are bombarding us. They go right through us. It's all around us. And science call it and neutrons. But the truth is, it could be called the spirit world, which the Indians talked about long ago. Something that you cannot see, you cannot feel, but it's detectable by science. What is that thing? What are these particles? We don't even know. But it's there. Is it God? Is it the great spirit? You can call it what you like. But they are there. There's so much mystery in this planet and this world. And that's why I love the Lakota world, Wakon Tanka. It literally means the great mystery. And I think that's part of the riddle of life. We're not meant to understand everything. I think when you live in mystery, life is exciting. It's the mystical aspect of life. When you explain everything, then it's boring. Just like when you start a movie, if you suss out what's happening in the plot line, the movie is boring because there's no excitement in the result or the final conclusion. But life is not supposed to be so you can see everything clearly down the road. A mystery, the mystical aspect of it, is what keeps it exciting. You never know who you're going to meet, what's going to happen, that's, to me, it's exciting, people. Let's celebrate that. Let's not be afraid of that,
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, get off my soapbox now.
Karen, may I ask a question?
Go ahead.
I watched you intensely when you were on The Missing with Tommy Lee Jones. It must have been amazing to be able to work with that gentleman. I also watched him when he starred on The Hunted with the training of tracking by Tom Brown Jr. And my son was under Tom Brown's teaching for a couple of years because he is a natural tracker. And but what I wanted to ask you is, in making the Missing and working with Tommy Lee Jones, did you find it that it came natural that you worked together as a team on filming the movie, and you did quite a bit of tracking in the movie as I watched it? And what I wanted to ask you was, did it come natural to both of you together as a team? And did you enjoy tracking with Tommy Lee?
Well, The Missing was a very unique project. And every time you're told that you're going to be with Ron Howard, Val Kilmer in a movie. Tommy Lee Jones is an incredible man. He's a scholar. And I'm getting quite a bit of interference on this end. Anyway, Tommy Lee Jones, being the scholar that he was, he really brought a lot of valid and incredible points to the movie. I mean, from the first table read, and I sat at the table with Ron Howard, Achilles Quinn, and Kate Blanchett, and all of these stars. They all had Oscars besides me. and we were talking about the creative aspect before the movie even began, and all the points he had really worked. And my, like, put buttons, and we kind of kept, like, throughout the shoot. The movie has been difficult to work. I should watch. It's all about them, and he comes to the he cares for work. The son of God, the cat, he takes you to bring it. So I approach it the same way. I always come into my movies with a mental picture. And when he saw that movie, he respected me as I respected him. And I think as the movie continued, my part actually got stronger because the powers who were involved as a survivor, who was Elvis Hugar, who was the grandfather of the Bill and Tia, all these elders told Ron Howard that Bucky Jones is with a real Chiricahua, he would not be leading the Chiricahua in the desert. No matter how successful he is, the Chiricahua would be the target. And also would be killing his flanker. It was written that Tommy healed Ace. But then he changed that to me during the healing because there was no way, if you're with a real Chiricahua, the guy who was raised with Chiricahuas is going to do the medicine, you know? So he was again open to all of that, despite the fact that he was the star, and yet he was open to allow me to do things that wasn't in the script because the Indians required it.
Right.
That's how our tradition is. And Tommy is part seven, although he doesn't speak about it publicly, but he's very proud of his native bloodline. And there was actually more tragic thought in the film, but you guys didn't really see it. But yes, there was things where I get off my horse and I track, you know. I mean, the Apaches were able to track people even from, like, the blade of grass was bent in a way to get down and taste that, you know, how long ago that grass might have been broken, which direction it might have gone. So Indians were always known as wonderful trackers throughout history. And
yeah.
And we, you know, I don't think that was emphasized as deeply in the movie, but I understand what you're saying. I enjoyed working with him tremendously, and the movie was an incredible film. To this day, it actually has got more accolades than it deserved when it was released back in 2004. But
yeah.
That was a wonderful project. It really was. It's one of my favorites to this day, and I got to work and portray the Apaches in an authentic way.
Yes, it also taught people about the Southwest American Indians. My father always used to say to me, "Take care of your people first, and then take care of yourself after." And that was something that he always installed in me as I was growing up, and he raised me, and he never stopped telling me that many times, because to him, his people came first, and he put them first. And I had a wonderful example in growing up in our native world, in our native culture, in growing up as being an American Indian and learning from elders from all over. And but that was the one thing that he installed, was always take care of your people first. And and when I watched The Missing, that was the one thing that I saw in the movie, was that he took care of his people first, as my father would say. And it kind of hit home. It hit that spot where, okay, my dad knew what he was teaching me, and taught me not only by example but by words. And many people called my father the wisdom keeper, and it was because his words were always so wise, and he always thought before he said, and he lived his life as he was born an Indian. And then I raised my son the same way, and my son can speak fluent Apache, and it's amazing that he learned to listen and pick it up and be able to speak it. And so when The Missing came out, he understood, because in the movie there was Apache spoken, and I was so proud of that. I was so very, very proud of that.
Yeah.
You spoke
the
Apache.
The language in The Missing, I've always said this, prior to The Missing, the Chiricahua language had never been heard in the country. I mean, the West Sioux did it, Toronto, should have been a classic because it had all the elements. It had the budget, it had the wonderful director, Walter Scott, but they took West Patch in that movie, which sounds more like Navajo. It's more rhythmic. But as an actor here in The Missing, the exact outside. And nothing made me proud that when I saw the movie, in the patches, between the theaters, after the showing, they came out, they made a circle around me, and they all bowed their heads. Because they had understood every line, every joke. And that was just the ultimate honor for me. And it really, to this day, because of that film, I have not stopped studying the language and learn and to sort of spread the truth about, you know, about our people, basically. It's just, you know, the band is only 300 fluent-speaking Chiricahuas left.
Yes.
And Elvis, who was our advisor, is actually the person who wrote, was one half of the person who wrote with Scott Rushmore, the first Apache English dictionary. So we had some amazing people on board, and Ron wanted us to be totally accurate. I mean, Elvis had it said, if you listen to any word we said, if you didn't like it, you'd make us say it again. So we were, we had the best working with us. So it's great to know that movie will live for years, and someone, and maybe 100 years from now, I can say, okay, that was like my blueprint for the character Keita was Naichi, who was her grandfather. And Naichi was, you know, one of the sons of Portis. And I, you know, my costume, the way I look, the way I present, and some say I even resembled him. And that's what it was. I tried to basically portray this noble warrior who was also a father, a caring man. And that's, you know, historically, Geronimo had got a lot of the press, but Naichi was head of the resistance when all of that was going on. He was the chief in power at the time. And not enough is said about, he was a great leader, and he did a lot for the Apaches right after his father was gone. And, you know, Taza and Naichi were the two sons, and Taza passed away, and Naichi was the last. And the bloodlines that now is on the reservation, who basically adopted me as their own, are the descendants of Chief Naichi. So it's we had, like, on The Missing, really the most authentic people we could get. And again, that's a testimony to what a masterful storyteller and filmmaker Ron Howard is. And then he does not cut corners, and he made an amazing film.
Yes, it was amazing.
You know?
I have to say that the one scene where they go in to rescue the girls that are being held hostage, and where your character meets his demise, I was literally standing up yelling no, because I thought you did such a great job with that movie that you shouldn't have been killed off that movie that quickly. Or you should have survived it all the way to the end, just like I thought Tommy Lee should have survived at the end. But, you know, it was an amazing movie.
Well, you were not the only person who said that. There was, I mean, Rachel Evan Woods, who's an award-winning actress, and she's grown up now, and she's wonderful. Back then was only 16, and she actually received hate mail for what she had done. And she wasn't happy about it either. But, you know, the way it was written, actually, my character was supposed to be killed even faster. I was the one who said, at least I'm a Chiricahua warrior. I have to fight for my life. And that's why there's that fight scene, and then they take me on the rock, and they give me what they call the warrior's death, which is they basically torture me. They cut my hamstring, open up my thighs, and you see it in the background horrifically as the girls watch that. That was, again, my suggestion, that should be in there. And my final word, as I take the blow by Eric Schrake, who played Peshidin, which was Gujudash. And Gujudash is a very simple phrase. But again, it was, again, my suggestion that should be in there. And again, Ron was open enough to allow it. And as I scream, Gujudash, that echoes in the canyon. And that's the moment that Tommy Lee awakens from his you know, they drugs him, and he awakens and he realizes he has to make his way home, and and then the hawk that flies over him and leads him home. Some
leads
thought
him
was
home.
My spirit. It was my spirit that takes him home, because he, you know, it was is a very symbolic moment. But that phrase, Gujudash, means literally, let all good things happen. And I love that phrase because it says so much in so little words. And that's what I love about Indian languages, that the phrase is not just a word. It can be a whole paragraph in one word. I mean, what does that mean, really, Gujudash? It means I want to surrender my will to something higher than myself. Although my intentions are good, I still believe someone higher must interfere to make this happen. In other words, I'm not an ego thinking I made it happen. I willed it, but I still want the will of something higher to help me make it happen. And that kind of humbleness, that kind of earthbound connection is what makes Indian philosophy and way of life so unique and so necessary in our ego-driven society today.
Right. You know, I had many people ask me, did they really exist, what they called the evil medicine man, did they actually really exist in our tribes out in the Southwest? And and I said, you know, I didn't. By then, my father had passed away, so I couldn't go to my father, and Little Wolf came from San Carlos, and he had passed away, and I had elders that were, you know, crossing over, and I wasn't able to actually say, well, maybe long ago, they may have, and I did not want to put out any wrong information, so I said I would have to research that in order to answer it properly, because my father is no longer with me.
I can tell you what we found while we're doing the movie was that, first of all, the Peshitin character was a fictional character. He was not necessarily just a Apache. He was supposed to be. Remember, the movie was based on a book called The Last Ride. And in the book, the character was even more odd and wicked. He was clot-footed, and his hand was like a claw. He was even more of a monster, really. But the idea was this guy who traveled and lived with the Comanches and went up north with all my brothers, and he learned, you know, all kinds of magic as he traveled and conjuring. And yes, conjuring was among American Indian tribes.
Very much.
A person who, and conjurers were put to death by certain tribes, like the Cherokees in the Cold Mountain. At the opening of the movie, Minghella had this ancient curse which was called to destroy life. And I had to actually go out, learn it. First of all, I had to find it and find an elder who was going to actually give it to me and learn it, Ketoa, and come back. And I was in the movie all the way to the last 2 or 3 weeks of the film before being released, when the studio suddenly decided to take over an hour of the movie down. They cut out over an hour of the film, and sadly that scene was lost. But the movie opened up with me teaching Jude that curse. And it was, you know, I learned then that conjuring really was, you know, it was a superstition was strong through the Indian tribe. And they believed, like, Apaches don't like the owl, they don't like the bear or the snake. So the three animals away from. And
right. Even taking a piece of a person's hair is very much real. It's very real.
And with the hand of the right medicine, I mean, to this day, there are medicine men that they say, stay away from him. He does bad voodoo or whatever. So, yes, they exist. But
yes.
But as far as what the movie was definitely was more dramatized than what might have been in real life. But yes, I mean, you know, we lived in a culture that, you know, I'm never going to deny someone's power, because, you know, just as there's good medicine, there's always bad medicine too.
Right.
So one without the other cannot exist. So, but I don't think in Apache culture, and, you know, there was evil medicine men roaming around. The part of the movie that people didn't get was that the backstory. Who was the Peshitin? Who was the band that was with him? And I can tell you that if you'd notice, most of them were scouts. They were U.S. Army scouts. And what happened to the American Indian scouts? Right after they served their country, they were stripped of their rankings. They were put into the same cattle train and sent to the reservation with the same people they betrayed. So for them, it was a double betrayal. They betrayed the Indians, then they got betrayed by the new nation that had just given them a ranking in the army. So they were very bitter, very upset. And Peshitin, being Eric's character, persuades them to band together and to go on one last ride. And that was the name of the book. One last ride through the Wild West, killing these girls, and they're going to just basically give one big finger to the U.S. carriers, saying, you know, come and get us if you can. And that's what the whole movie was. These were desperados, angry at what happened to them, and they had justification. They were just being evil for being evil. They just were Indians who got betrayed more than once, and they were like, okay, to hell with that. We're going to get even with the people. Kind of like, I hate to say it, but it's like what's happening now in Afghanistan with Taliban, you know? It's like, you know, historically. Huh? Sorry?
It's okay. Like, I had some feedback coming back onto the line. I'm sorry about that.
No, I said, many of our own problems, from what I've seen in my research, like the Viet Cong and even the Taliban, were people that we were involved in their training at some stage. And then when they were fully trained and capable, and they went and fought their own war, and that war was over, then they turned on us, like the prodigal son. And that's what tends to happen in our history over and over again. When you're in a position of power and you're able to give certain technology and knowledge to people, that might work against you one day. And, this is what's happening now throughout the world. All these countries who are angry at America, not at the American people, but at our government, is because of they feel like the injustice that we've done. And, you know, most people don't understand our foreign policy for obvious reason. But if you knew, you would share the view of some of these ethnic races and why they're so bitter and upset at us, why they want to harm or hurt us. You know, I mean, and that's what I'm saying again. As a global community, we have to be more responsible what we do with everybody else's life and community. We can't just go in, yes, our economy develops, but while we create a war somewhere else. That's just not the way to do it. You know, and I think it's finally caught up to us. It's finally caught up to, you know, our karma is finally caught up to us. That's what I'm saying. And the only way we're going to get out of this situation now is we have to reinvent ourselves as a nation that deserves to be. I mean, we are Americans, we always say, we're the greatest nation on earth. But lately we've been asking, are we really? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's that moment in history now. So anyway,
very interesting. I myself worry about once our young people get more and more deeper into the electronics of today, and I'm speaking of our culture in particular, will they remember to listen to our elders? Will they do as I was raised to sit at many, you know, powwows and sit and listen to the elders teach you just by a few words or an example or and learn the rights and wrongs of respect, and that was something that I you know, took my son when he was just a baby, and then growing up in he became known as the powwow kid because he knew all the elders and they were teaching them one by one, you know, how to respect and honor the dances, and I worry that in time, at some point, all the things that you learned, that Karen has learned, that all of us have learned through our deep teachings will will be lost.
Well, I mean, then part of our duty is to preserve them. Look what Steven Spielberg did. He went and recorded all these elders of the Hebrew community, all these Holocaust survivors, and put them in a library of videos. So for 100 years from now, people can go and listen to these stories firsthand, and that's what we have to do. We have to preserve what these elders have to say. Each tribe should take responsibility, recording their elders, keeping a library, because it's not like the old days. Yes, the young don't want to necessarily sit around a campfire or listen to old stories. This is a new generation. They're texting. They're on Facebook. We have to appeal to them through their way of communication. We can't expect this new generation to sit in long, lengthy, traditional ways of learning. So our job is to preserve this, to preserve the stories and pass it down as best as we can. Whether somebody will listen to us, you know, I mean, one of the young men that I'm really supporting is this Colorados Mangus, the young Apache boy who is a descendant of Mangus, the chief Mangus, and he went to Washington a year or so ago and stood before the Congress and spoke about the suicide prevention of the youth. And that's another issue that's unspoken. You know, I mean, Indian nations, they tend to hide their embarrassment, and we have to address that there's a real, I mean, the suicide rate among the teens is 3.5 times the nation. That's not a joke. They're killing each other, killing themselves at an unbelievable rate. I mean, sometimes in groups, one kills himself on Tuesday, one on Thursday, one on Wednesday. I mean, how can a 14-year-old girl have that much misery to want to end her own life? These are questions that need answering. We need to reach out not just to the elders, but the youth. The youth are lost. They don't know who they are anymore. They don't know if they should stay on the res. I talk to these kids. They're afraid of leaving the reservation. They're afraid of living the life they want. I always tell them that, you know, they need to spread their wings and fly. You know, just like the eagle pushes the chicks out of the nest, they fall first before they fly. So you got to be brave. You got to leave the nest. You can always come back. Look, I don't live on the res, but I visit the res at least several times a year, and I do whatever I can to bring prosperity or work over there. You know, whether I bring volunteers to work and do the thing or you know, take a BBC America show on the reservation where not just it will, people all around the world is going to see the Apache culture in a completely different light, you know, as a family-oriented, wonderful, loving, warm, you know, people. Not the savage we've seen Westerns running around going, you know, that's like, that stuff is done. It's old hat. And it has to now be portrayed accurately and correctly. And ultimately, we're just people, you know. It's just there's so much people when they meet an Indian, they always go, you know, they think like it's going to be more than, we're just human beings, people. It's like, you know, it's a wonderful culture, but our blood is just as red as anyone else. It's no different. I don't really feel, you know, there's so many foolish people out there, I don't even mention name, but who are so focused on blood quantum and who is the real Indian, who's not. They are such pathetic people. Ignorant. And that's why they're nowhere. I mean, those very people make those claims. If you look at them, most of them are doing nothing with their lives. They're going nowhere. They don't have a life. And that's why they spend their time trying to create discord among others. You know?
Right.
The reality is we're the human race. And we got to get to that, you know? If you and I share the same blood type, I can give you my organ. Okay, so how different are we really? You know, I mean, come on. It's time to awaken and embrace this, you know, all this separation and segregation that's holding people back.
Right.
You know?
See, my son's friends, his peers, my son went out in the woods and he built his own campsite, and he's a fire keeper, so he knew how to dig, build his own fire pit and cook on it and live in the woods if he wanted to spend the night out in the wilderness. He's not he has no fear of any of our standing brothers or our winged ones or our four-legged brothers and sisters. And But as peers do, and he has learned, and I have taught him the difference of maybe being with his own people for now until the peers that have fear of all these things, whether it be snakes or what have you, until they can understand where his heart and his spirit is coming from, he has chosen to walk his path on his own. And it's very, in many ways, sad to see that peers can separate from one person because he was raised in a much different manner than they were, and therefore to them he's different in so many ways that they refuse to understand the culture that he was raised on and what he's capable of doing. And that's when I look at that and I see that, that's where the young people of today have so many different choices in life and paths to take, but they're all separate. They do it separately.
Yeah.
What do you suggest to those that want to help with and get involved with helping these children on the reservations that are committing suicide and helping the elders too as well?
Well, they're totally separate issues. You know, I mean, that's why I don't even mix them. There was a wonderful program on the Apache Reservation that was created by the Apaches, and it was called the Honor Your Life Program. And last year, I went out there for a whole week with my producing partner, Alexander Bubenheim, and another German friend who's a famous actor in Germany, actually, Tor. And we were just shocked to hear the stories. And it was both moving and powerful, but every single day I was left in tears. Whether I gave a speech or when I listened, it was unbelievable. And it's a very delicate subject, so it's not like you can just pick up your bag and walk into a reservation and say, I'm here to help with this suicide prevention. It doesn't work like that.
Right.
So what I suggest is find out what each nation has got going. If your skills as a health provider or a psychologist or a therapist, if you're in that department, can help them and volunteer yourself, find out who's the head of the organization and approach them with respect. Because one thing I always try to emphasize is that Indian nations do not beg for anything. They don't ask for anything.
Nope.
You know, and if you approach them, you have to approach them in their way, with respect. You know, they may not have financial power, but, you know, I always say to my elders, I said, you know, financially you may not be wealthy, but culturally you're some of the richest people in the world.
Yeah.
And this is a culture that's ancient, and it's very proud. It's a lot of pride that goes in it, and you have to approach it in their way, as you know. And you cannot approach it even with the BBC. When they first tried to get the show on the reservation, they went to the council and they got rejected. And
mm-hmm.
and they came back to me and said, can you get us on there now? And I had to pull some fast things and do some political stuff to get them on, you know, get them back on the show and to be able to do their show there, you know. So it's the way you approach it. It's very important. Now, a program like Adopt a Native Elder is more open to outsiders because it's run by white, brown, yellow, and red people. Every race is present there. And one of the founders is a white woman. So it's not. But if you're going to go into a program that's created and run by Indians, then you have to approach them and see if they want your involvement, if what you've got to give is what then. If they want you, they'll let you know. But don't run in there because you're some kind of a psychologist and you've had many years of experience with suicide prevention, thinking because that's your credentials, you're automatically welcome or they need you. That's not how it works. And I say always, be aware of the cultures you approach, know what their tradition and custom is, and approach it with respect and dignity, and you may be involved. But But to just rush in, it doesn't work. And it's just like anything else. You approach it with education. Inform yourself. Learn. If you can't find anything, research it. Even if you have to travel there to find out, then you have to travel there. But it just really takes effort, time. A lot of people don't have that. You know, it's not just I get everyday people writing me, I like to be involved. I like to do something. What can I do? But with Adopt a Native Elder, it's easy. You can go on their website. You can donate your money very simply, and they have different donations. You can buy a medicine box for $60 or more. They have food bundles and medicine bundles. It's not expensive. You can buy wool because they need the wool to weave their amazing rugs they do. And or you could actually volunteer your time and go to one of the food runs and be part of the convoy. But then you have to pay your own little accommodation in a hotel nearby, and you got to take your own SUV or car to be able to be part of the convoy and to take the food to the location. So there are ways to do it. And ultimately, in a very simple way, what you can do is to help someone like me spread the news. When I put something on my Facebook, share it with your friends. You know, support me on my Huffington Post. Share that and spread the news, because information is power, and that's the first step to try to make a difference, to educate people, let them inform people, and let them make a decision on themselves. I never insist or persist. That's not really an Indian way anyway. So you give the information, and you wait for them to take a step by themselves. So.
Well, we want to extend our offer also to you have full support of this radio show, and anytime there's something that needs to be put out there, not only with Facebook, but we're also willing to do that with this radio show as well. We have helped with some other issues, such as the destruction of some of the burial sites, which we both disagree with 100% with that. Yeah. We have fought very hard as far as trying to save some of those, and we thought we did save one, but unfortunately the city ended up taking it anyway, and it was 4,500-year-old burial mound. So it was with Wounded Knee, and they took it after more than 150,000 signatures and phone calls and emails telling them why they should not do it, and they ended up doing it.
Well, here's a number that I can give on air if you want. If anybody just wants to make a donation, here's a number. The lady's name is Anita, and if you call 801-673-2876, 801-673-2876, there's a lady called Anita, and you can make a donation on the phone. You can take your credit card, boom, right there, $5, $10, $20, $100, whatever you want to donate. Was the Firewood program or my program, which is the Warming Hearts, is just as simple as that. If you don't want to go through the website and go through all of that paperwork, this is another way you can do it. Just call that number, 801-673-2876, and make a donation towards Warming Hearts, and you've helped an elder during these harsh times. So, you know, it's just getting the information out or running ads. I mean, last year I actually did like over 15 different radio interviews. And it made a difference. I feel like because of that, I had such an amazing turnout in Utah last November. And so, you know, in my own little ways, and eventually I'm launching my own 501c, and I will have my spirit volunteers do more work than just with the Native youth and the Navajo elders. I want to work with Pine Ridge, because that's a reservation that needs a lot of help. And River. And, you know, there's a lot of places. And I want to be able to take my spirit volunteers in any direction. And I see us growing. You know, my community is growing. And, you know, and again, as I said, I've got a few naysayers and haters out there, and who've been spreading a lot of false information about me out there, trying to, like, basically stop my progress. And it was so ironic. These are Indians doing this, which for me makes it the worst type of crime ever, you know. And their whole basis is based on the fact that I'm not an Indian. Now, here's the thing: I don't care if I was from Mars. What I do as a human being, okay?
Right.
What I do is because I've built a relationship with the elders and the youth and these reservations. And I don't care if I don't have a res card. I don't care if my, you know, my face looks this or that, the other. None of that matters. None of my elders or the youth that I deal with ever ask me who I am or where I'm from. They just look at me as a caring person who's come with a blessing. And that's what it's about, people. Don't be shy. Don't be worried because you're this, that, the other. Human beings are human beings. You reach out. You help people in need. That's what it's about. Okay?
That's right.
Have to stop. You know, this is the biggest danger facing the Indian nations right now are these little self-proclaimed vigilantes who are really nobodies. I advise all of you, these people who point fingers at me, do your research. Go online. Research these people. You will find they are done zero for their people. They are just
right.
haters spreading false hate constantly. There's one woman that I don't want to mention her name who lives in Lancaster, claims to have an entertainment company that she runs out of a P.O. box. It's like people like her are the worst criminals out there, you know? And you know what? My attorney has been collecting all the information she's been putting out there, and one day soon she's going to get the surprise of her life. But, you know, I don't defend myself because they're not worth me defending myself. I will continue to do what I do, and none of these losers are going to ever stop me. I mean, that's the reality. And you know what? Whenever you have haters, you know you're doing something right. Because if I was really as insignificant as they say, would they spend so much time and effort? I mean,
it's
you know,
jealousy.
I'm on her Facebook. She refers to me on a daily basis, I've been told. On a daily basis. She's so obsessed. She's like a stalker. And now they're spreading information that I'm a woman hater. I've got so many lawsuits against women against all of this. I got to clear the air again. I've never been arrested in my life. I don't have any charges ever brought up against me. There's been allegations in the past, but I have never been ever. I don't have it. Go try to find a criminal record on me. Impossible. Never been any one of those things. So anyone who's spreading those lies, that's slander. And if you continue doing so, believe you me, you will come into a court of law and pay for your lies
that's
one day.
Right.
So
that's right.
I'm going to leave it at that. But they're not going to get to me, and they're not going to stop me. In fact, they only encourage me to work harder and to do more good. And that's the reality. And you know what? It's the tragicness of Indians right now that some Indians on the reservation look at the urban Indians, or you're not an Indian, you don't live on the res, or you haven't gone through ceremony, or you left when you were young, or you did, your mother is part of this. It's nonsense, people. Get over
yeah.
it. You know? Right. And even the Indian community in Hollywood, which is so small, it's so not united. You know, the Indian celebrities are not even happy for each other's success. And I understand it's a competitive business, but in every other race, if you see the African Americans, the Hispanic, whatever, there's a community feel where they support each other, where they work with each other to try to encourage more work out of each other. But here, it's sadly like, you know, the Hollywood community is very cutthroat. And
my brother was up for a Grammy as the best new artist this year, and the Native community was in this area in the Eastern Woodlands. They were not even happy for him that he had succeeded to that point in his CDs, and his CDs are beautiful. And then I have another brother in Hurricane, Utah. His name is Black Hawk, and he travels all around doing Native concerts and sings and plays the drum, and he has found groupies, jealousy, things that you're speaking of, and he tells me about them and in his travels, and how awful it is that the Native people argue with each other, and there's no love and support there for each other, so they travel it alone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, these very same people who are so into, like, I'm a full blood, I'm a whatever, I say, well, then take pride in how you look, you know? It's like, you know, if you look at our ancestors, they were not these overweight people running around. They were athletic. They took care
exactly.
of their bodies. Their bodies were healthy. They didn't eat fried bread. They didn't live this life they do now. They didn't drink alcohol. They didn't do any of this stuff these guys are doing. So, for me, if you're really proud of your people, then walk the road. Be an
right.
example for the people. Don't just be there preaching preaching stuff of hatred or whatever, and that's another thing. A real Indian doesn't hate. You don't spread a gossip.
Right.
Hate, you know? You know, like here's another example I was going to tell you. Because I defended this one actor in Hollywood years ago called Ionized Cody. Ionized Cody, after the truth came out that he was actually Italian or part Italian or whatever. And this is the guy that some people kind of make me like because I won an Italian championship. Now, here's the truth. Ionized Cody in 1950s, who was the at the time one of the most famous Indian actors in Hollywood that got all these big roles.
Right.
Look at historically, he became a huge advocate of Indian rights. He did so much in the name of Indians, where later on in the 60s or 70s, he was awarded a special honorary award by the Indian nations and justly deserved his place in history, just like another character called Archibald Grayal. Archibald Grayal was a trapper in Canada who claimed to be Apache, and years later they found out he was really an Englishman, and he was not Apache at all, but he became one of the first environmentalists. There was a movie made about him that Pierce Brosnan played, and it was called Grayal, and Sir Richard Attenborough directed it. And this guy went all over the world giving lectures on American Indians, and in one of his lectures, a young five-year-old, which was Richard Attenborough, was listening, and years later he made the movie about it. So that's how much influence he... But these characters throughout history who may not have been born as an Indian but lived the life and walked the red road, to me, were just as important as some of the chiefs we've had. And even our chiefs acknowledge that. And we must acknowledge that, you know, sometimes it's the road you walk that defines you, not the bloodline you were born into.
Right.
You know, when you become a samurai, it doesn't matter if you're not Japanese, you're a samurai. You know how to use the katana. That's what it's about. If the hand that wields it, it doesn't matter what genetic makeup it is, you know? And yet you could be proud of culture, but if someone is doing good in the name of that culture and whatever, you know, and the poor Ionized Cody gets so much slack where he was a faker. Was this? Listen, in the 1950s, Hollywood didn't know any better. There was Jewish and Italian actors playing, and there was other actors, by the way, throughout history of Hollywood, playing multiple races. That's what acting is about. If you're just going to play yourself, then why is it acting? You know? And that's why I encourage fellow brothers and sisters to be an actor. Don't just, you know, whenever they want an Indian in leathers and feathers, you're ready to be Indian number four in the background, ride your horse. That's not acting, you know?
Right.
You know, you want to be an actor, then be an actor and play more than just one type of roles, if you can. I mean, that's
right.
Really what it comes down to.
What it comes down to. That's right.
Yeah. So,
I was going to say, Iron Eyes Cody made an impact on me when I was a child. I guess maybe 4 or 5 years old with that one commercial, and he didn't have to say a word, not one word, and that made a huge impact on me.
It was a PSA, actually. It was a public service announcement, and I was going to do a recreation of that a few years ago where he talks about pollution and the river, and the one tear comes down his face, and he says, Chief America Clean. It's probably, it was voted as one of the most memorable commercials in the history of television. That and a Coca-Cola commercial that was done with Mean Charlie Brown, whatever the football player's name was. Those two are the most remembered commercials in history. So, but I'm not even talking about that. It's just the fact is, you know, all this hatred exists because he was faking something, you know. And I say, well, how was he faking when he did all this good in the name of Indianhood, you know?
Exactly.
You know, you know, these are the issues, and it's so fun. If you always look at the people who complain, it's not someone who's successful. It's always someone who's not successful in what they're trying to do. Someone who's trying to be in the profession you're in, and they can't get in. So what do they do? They decide to try to cut someone else down because they can't make it themselves. They can't get anywhere themselves. And someone else says, oh, he's a fake. Let's analyze him and break him down or whatever, you know? It's like a lot of claims are made on my behalf. I've been called Italian, Peruvian, Israeli, Arab, Persian. All of these races I've been claimed to, which obviously means I'm doing my job right because I played all those characters in my film, you know? But I don't get offended when I get all these names, you know? It's like I am Jay Tavern. And if anyone wants to come out and who knows my parents or whatever and prove that I'm not, then do so. Otherwise, what you're saying is just hearsay. And I encourage anyone who hears these people who claim big things, who can't even pronounce my second name, to ask them for their proof. Tell them to get prove it to
That's
you.
That's right.
You know, then you have something. Then you have what else. You can go around and see. And the problem with lying is if you repeat, I mean, I saw this recently on Facebook. It was a picture of Hitler, and he said, tell a lie, make it big, repeat it often, eventually it will be accepted as truth. So that's why sometimes I stand up to my naysayers, because if you keep repeating a lie, people are going to just accept it. You know, most of the time I don't do anything, but once in a while I challenge all of these people who claim things, come and have a debate. Come and have a debate with me. Let me see, you know, what you can handle. You know, I'm not afraid. It's just so, it's like, you know, we got to get past these differences. We got to get past all of this naysaying and get to where we're actually making a difference, because there's so many problems that exist right now, bickering over bloodlines. And I tell you something, anyone who's willing to help me is welcome. You can have one leg and be Chinese. I don't care. It's if you're willing to help, you are a help to me. And that's what I encourage. It's like, who cares where the person is from? You know, it's like, well, how is that going to change the difference? Sometimes it's the ones who are not from the bloodline who have actually more of a connection with the people, you know?
Right.
You know, Germans have an amazing obsession with Indians because of the books of Karl Marx.
Yes.
And Winnetou, this character Winnetou that for many years I've been asked to portray. And some people make fun of them. They say Germans are old, they want to play Indian or whatever. And they even have, like, festivals where they have campsites where they're all dressed in
buckskin. They wear chokers.
Yeah, they wear chokers. You know, they dress in regalia. They live as Indians for months in the wilderness. Now, some people might frown upon that. And I say, why? They've taken the best of our culture and they celebrate it.
Yes.
That is not anything negative. We should be, you know, imitation is the highest form of compliment, you know, it's a flattery, you know. Imitation.
We had
I'm
sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to tell you, we had a trading post here, and it was called Fort Cherokee, and one day we were all in there and just visiting with each other, and a family of German people came in, and they all had chokers on, and they could barely speak English. It was more German. We tried so hard to understand them. They were such kind and warm people, and they told us how much they loved our culture, and they shopped until they couldn't shop anymore, but we ended up, you know, giving hugs before they went down the stairs, and we told them to come back and see us, and they ended up coming to one of the local powwows the next weekend, and they saw us, and it was beautiful, because all it takes is, like you said, it doesn't matter where you come from or who you are. It's the smile and the warmth in your eyes that makes the communication of the world. And us as American Indians have had so much bickering between each other that that's something I said to Karen the other day. It's sad because Indians are arguing with Indians. Why? And that's what I ask. Why? Why cannot we get along and love each other? And then I look at other races, and they're not doing that. They're embracing life with each other.
Well, what I can answer you what's going on. I mean, there's several reasons for this. One of it is a systematic ideology that's passed down from...
Oh, no. He'll probably call right back because we just lost him for a moment, so I do apologize for that, guys. In the meantime, he's making a great point for everybody to listen to, because it really does not matter what color your skin is. It matters where your heart is and what you're willing to do. So I think that should be a big, big thing there, and that everybody should really think about that instead of fighting among themselves about whose blood's what and who isn't. And we have Jay back, so let's bring him back on.
Okay.
Hi, Jay.
I guess the BIA didn't like what I have to say, but really, I mean, that's another joke that I haven't even got to. You know, for every Indian on the reservation, there's a 5 or 6 BIA agents. I mean, what the hell is going on there? All that taxpayer money going for just to watch one Indian on the reservation? I mean, people. I mean, listen, our system, people always say, what can we do to change it? Well, you know, you have to change everything. You can't just change one thing. And there's so many, the system has been in place for so long that it's difficult. So really the change has to begin from us as a community on the inside. You know?
Right.
I mean, people talk about the casino monies and all of that, and that's one of the reasons why there's this bickering sometimes, because right now, obviously, lots of people want to be Indian to either become enrolled into a tribe or be part of this tax-exempt or start a casino, all of that stuff. Well, I'm not one of those guys. I want to make that clear. I've never wanted to have a res card because, for me, the very government who sort of eradicate my people then now says they decide who's Indian but give them a little res card. Well, you know what? I'm not interested in that. And I don't want to have any different rights. I don't want to not pay my taxes. So for me, my claims, it's just personal. It's not for any other type of gains, you know? So, but really, I understand why there's that delicacy among some tribes, because if someone is trying to benefit from being an Indianhood, then that's different, you know? And that's like, I feel like the last thing that's left for Indians that live on the reservation is our culture. And if someone is coming, like what they call cult of vultures, and they're trying to take that and turn it into spiritual books or videos or whatever, that is something that, you know, we should watch out for. But ultimately, the anger and the hatred among even among one tribe, forget intertribal, that's just, it's just sad, because it's unnecessary, and I feel like if we unite, the power that we'll generate will be unbelievable. I mean, even this casino money that people think should make such a difference is only going back right now to pay the interest on those expensive hotels and resorts that were built. It's not trickling down. They're getting taxed up yin-yang, a lot of the casinos. You know, out of the 565 nations, there are about 230 casinos. And you know, in California, which are some of the richest, they gross over $10 billion a year. So, but this money is not trickling down like you imagine. There are tribal members who are wealthier, but overall, like for example, the Apache, I know the Apache Reservation in Manitou God, it's a heavily taxed casino. I mean, that thing costs $90 million to build. And, you know, majority is this high rates of interest that has to be paid back. And, you know, so it's very complex situation, and from the outside it's easy to say, well, you don't pay taxes, you have all that casino money, why are you complaining? It's not like that. To this day, an average Indian family lives with $10,000 less money than the poorest American anywhere in America. So we're living below poverty levels. You know, unemployment is the highest, 80% on Pine Ridge. I mean, it's like, the statistics are unbelievable. Mortality rate for a male is between 46 to 55. I mean, people, come on, diabetes and heart disease and all of these issues, those are the things we've got to address. I mean, one of my things that I'm going to work towards, my own charity I'm going to work with, is health and fitness. I'm a big advocate of taking care of your body, because your body is your temple. And you have to take care of it. What you put in your mouth, what you put into your lungs, what you drink, all of those things has an effect on you as a spirit, as a being. And you have to be careful what you're doing. And you have to treasure this gift of life and preserve yourself. And that's the only way you're going to set an example for the next generation. You know, if they see you smoking and abusing it, well, how easy it is for them to do the same thing. So it's you know, the complexity is, you know, I wish there was a simple answer. I wish there was a switch you could flick, you know, and, but it's not. It's a layered, multi-layered, complex issue. And like you said, the difference between what we can do for the elders and what we can do for the youth, two separate issues completely. So, anyway.
It definitely needs to be addressed. I mean, this is stuff that's going on in this country that should not be going on at all.
But we're not very high on the list of, you know, I mean, Obama just signed, you know, because a lot of people say, what have you done for Indians? Well, he actually signed an amazing treaty recently that I posted on my Facebook that it's going to enable, you know, all kinds of funds and communication lines with the Indian chiefs, and they'll be able to, you know, achieve better goals in the end. But but we're still a long way from where we need to be. And I see it coming, but it's going to take us from inside. Yeah, the leaders, the people on the inside, we have to, like, even the elders, we have to just think differently. We have to, try to get help in every way we can.
Mm-hmm. I think myself, our president, I think he embraces our culture. I know that he has said many times in public that he has Native American blood in him. I admire that. I know that when he first was campaigning, my son had just turned 18, and he wanted my son's vote, and they literally waited, his campaign people, for my son to come down to the voting poll. And when we weren't there 5 minutes earlier, they called, where is he? You know, it was amazing to think that they picked one young man to put in his first vote for the President of the United States. And when I pulled up and I promised them I'd be there in 5 minutes, I was a little confused of why the attention was on my son when there are so many young people out there. But for some reason they had taken an interest in Robert, and it could have been because he had spoken to William and Mary, the college here, and taught three classes on tracking, and they did an interview in the newspaper there. And I don't know whether it was something to do with that or whether it was the fact that he was an American Indian young man who grew up walking the life of who he was and is proud of who he is, and is very quiet-mannered, but will tell you in a minute, because his father, Swamp Rat, played with Colin Farrell on The New World, and when they filmed it here in Virginia. And so he quietly is proud of all that has been achieved so far. But President Obama was, of course, his choice as a president because he had promised that he would help our people. And that was my first question: what will you do for my people? And it was a very deep concern of mine.
Yeah. Well, he certainly has done more than most presidents have done in this first 4 years. And I encourage everyone to vote for him again, because watching the news, the Republican candidates and the debates, honestly, it was Comedy Central. I mean, it was kind of entertaining. I mean, now it's kind of like cooled off, but those debates they destroyed each other. I mean, that's, again, another leaf from politics you learn is that, you know, politicians learn that long term ago. When you tell a lie about your opponent, 2 weeks down the road, it doesn't matter if it was a lie. Half the people already believe it. The other half will always have a doubt about that topic. So that's why I always encourage people to really seek the truth and find for yourself, not with just somebody preaching someone something about someone. Find the answers for yourself. I mean, that's the Indian way, to know, to learn for yourself, you know? And don't listen to somebody out there preaching hate and anger and, oh, you know, so-and-so is this, so-and-so is that, fine for yourself, you know? And, but, I mean, we could talk about this forever. We're in a very symbolic period in history. Even this date, 2012, on the Mayan calendar, you know, this is not end of time. This is end of a cycle of time. You know? And the Mayan marks it for a reason, you know, and it, you can feel the earth vibrations are changing, you know. And a lot of people have anxiety, but it's really, especially women. I find a lot of my female friends, they can't sleep at night, they feel anxious. There's a lot of that stress there. And I always try to explain to them that, you know, women are just more intuitive. They're more in touch with these vibrations. And what they're feeling is these earth changes happening. And don't interpret it in a negative way. Just because you're feeling it, just keep the peace, meditate on it, and see what lessons are coming to you. Because really, I mean, I've always said this. I find that female is the most advanced creature on the planet. I know a lot of men are going to dislike me for saying this, but they really are. You know, I mean, as far as the only creature who is able to do things that no other animal on the planet does, including cleansing its blood, the cycles of the moon. You know, I could go on and on, the abilities that a female has that no other creature on the planet has. Intuition and the ability to make decisions more clearly, since there's not enough testosterone running around in their head. Which might not be true when I talk about LA women.
Well, you know, that not only pertains to us as human beings, but also I've watched the animals around us. You know, it is the mothers of the four-legged brothers and sisters and the winged ones that are the very adamant caretakers of their youngings and their babies. And it is with those that we live on this earth with that are in very much as emotionally bonded with their children as we are. And a lot of people don't see that. They don't take time to watch nature or to watch a squirrel, feed its young or a osprey go and or an eagle fish for its babies. And this is something that I do on a daily basis, and I embrace it, and my son embraces it, and we watch as the mother takes care of her babies. But many people ignore nature; they ignore the natural the cycles of life that is all around us, the wind, everything, the elements. At all, and it just it baffles me. How can people ignore the rightful ones on this earth? And it's just, you know, I understand too that they're so wrapped up in the electronic things of today. Like me, I don't own a cell phone. You know, my father raised me on the old fashioned stamp and envelope and post office, you know, and he did. And that was what I was raised on. You know, he raised me to be old fashioned and I'm glad.
I have absolutely no problem with that. But what I say is, don't become a slave. In fact, I have a song on my album, Tears of a Shaman. By the way, for all the listeners, if you can go to tearsofashaman.com, you can learn all about the album, the mission, the cause, because at the heart of this album is a powerful cause for the elders and the youth. That's why we made this album. And we have a song called Technological Slaves, Techno Slaves. And we talk about that to gain this technological advantage, we had to give up something. And what we gave up was the sacred way of life. And we got detached from who we really are. And we have to make that connection once again. But at the same time, I don't believe, like I talk about Taoism in China, you know, a nation that doesn't believe in change. For thousands of years, they've done something exactly the same way. Were they correct? Now that we look down the road, I don't believe so. I look at a country like us. We encourage entrepreneurship. We encourage different ways of thinking. We encourage people who can think outside the box. That's how you get. That's what nature wants. We cannot stop progress, and we cannot stop change. So what I say is, don't lose the fact of what your father taught you. All those things are wonderful. But at the same time, if emails are faster than writing on a piece of paper, use it, but don't be a slave to it. Like my phone, I tell my friends, I don't always answer my cell phone. Just because it's with me, it doesn't mean you can contact me at all times of day. You know, it records the message or the text, and when I'm ready, I'll see who contacted me. Don't become a slave to your PDAs and your cell phones and your computers or even Facebook. I mean, I have people on Facebook that write me every single day, and they expect me to, they forget I have 10,000 people on there. It's impossible for me to be able to read or answer every single person every single day, especially when you're telling me about just how your life is. I mean, sometimes there are messages that they do demand a reply. Someone, you know, you'd be surprised how many people reach out to me in moments of darkness in their life when they've lost a family member or they're losing a family member, and they want me, they, I don't know, for what I've become this life carrier where people reach out to me for a word of inspiration in a moment of darkness, and for whatever reason I haven't denied those people that, and I reach out to those people without knowing. And it's so ironic that years later, those very people that I helped might end up as part of my team Taveray. You know, I have a wonderful lady, her name is Claudia. She's a mom in Holland. And I've never met her, but I've known her for a decade online. And I, unbeknownst to me, I met her when she was going through the loss of her grandfather, and I wrote this beautiful letter to her. And that letter moved her so much that to this day, she's become one of my moderators in Holland, and she operates one of my websites and has done a tremendous amount of work for me. And so all of that came from me just reaching out to a stranger. I didn't even look at her name. I just read the letter. It moved me, and I answered it. So that's the type of acts of kindness I encourage everyone to do, is don't always worry what's in it for you, because, you know, the payback might not be immediate. Do it anyway. I'm not saying be a slave and just constantly give your stuff for free, but when your heart says it's okay, do it, because your payback will be somewhere else. It'll be paid forward. And you got to have that kind of a trust. And with our mothers and the females in our family, they are truly, I always said, they're the superheroes of every family. Mothers should have a cape with a superhero outfit, because what they do is unbelievably heroic and difficult. You know, anyone who's ever raised a little dog, which I have rescued animals and I rehabilitate them. In fact, my little pooch that I found in the street 2 years ago, cleaned her up, trained her, just did her first television show this weekend. It was unbelievable. Landed a pilot on a show. She got paid handsomely to be on it, and now she's paying her own grooming and dog food this month. So, I put the little bitch to work. But it's just like, you know, that type of exchange you should seek. You know, people who are expressing depression or whatever, I say, you know, get out the house, get out of your environment, start doing things with other people. You know, we are social creatures. This internet, like you said, it's really unhealthy sometimes, because it gives you a false sense of friendship. You know, you're sitting at home, you're typing, and everybody's replying. You think, but you're not having any real communication as such. So it's still important to keep that social aspect of human beings, where you're around other human beings and, you know, you having meals. And it's so important for our spirit. And that's why these, I find Indian nations and the tribal aspect of our thing, it's so important. It's that closely knit bond of being, you know, with a group of people and just enjoying. That's what holidays are. You know, I don't really celebrate Easter's or Passover or Christmases and all that stuff, but I respect all of them, And if I get invited to my Jewish friends, I'll put it on the Quran, and I'll drink their sweet wine, and I'll respect Yahweh. And if I go to my Christian friends, I'll sing to Jesus and remember him and his teachings, because he was a wonderful master. There's no denying that. That's completely different with what the Vatican has become. But the truth is, the teachings of the Prophet was amazing. And the same with Islam. You know, we keep looking at Muslims, and unfortunately because of 9/11 and such a negative connotation that's been pushed out there, you know, not everyone who's a Muslim is a negative or dark person, or God forbid, a terrorist, you know. It's like the word Islam literally means to surrender to God. A Muslim means, you know, someone who's Muslim, they call it Muslim, it's someone who surrenders and who's at peace. The idea is to find, and they have wonderful, wonderful teachings. You know, the Arabs brought to the world algebra, alchemy. You know, there's so many, astronomy. You know, all of these things were gifts from the Arabs. So let's not forget the contribution of different races where we are in history today. You know, the African Americans have invented so many things through the American history that is forgotten, you know. In fact, an African-American woman invented something I was recently reading about that blew my mind. I said, how come that's not more well-known, you know? So you have to, we have to acknowledge this, you know, everyone's input. And it's not just one race, you know. You know, the idea of the master race that the Hitler had is a fallacy. The only master race is the people who evolved consciously.
Right.
And the only master you are is the master of yourself, because all other control is an illusion. You know, if you can control yourself and your emotional state, as much control that you can ever ask for in life. All the rest is an illusion. It really is. I mean, quantum physics right now has shown that at every given moment, there's infinite possibilities. Anything can happen. Anything is possible. The one that you believe strongest is the one you actually see. The one becomes real in your eyes.
That's right.
You know, you can literally create that reality if you focus on it and manifest it, basically. You know, and our elders had those powers. I mean, I tell this story with goosebumps sometimes, that I was invited once to sit with a group of elders at a medicine council, and I sat for 4 hours with all these elders in a circle, and not a word was spoken. And they all were all like in a meditative state. So after 4 hours, foolishly, I broke the silence. I turned around to the elder and said, are we going to... I mean, I thought I was invited here to learn something. Are we going to talk? And then he just looked at me, without even looking at me, he kind of says, we are talking, kid. You know? And I never forgot that. And I have no doubt in my mind that was not a joke, that these guys were telepathically talking. Something
exactly.
was going on in that room that I was unaware of, because, you know, that's the level of evolution that our culture had, you know. I mean, I always remember the writer of Into the West, Mastronami, who is an Italian gentleman, saying to me that as he wrote Into the West for Spielberg, he realized it was one of the only times in the history of man that the conquerors, being the settlers, were inferior to the conquered people, being the Indians. He actually acknowledged that. He said, but because the Indians were dressed in leathers and feathers and painted faces, they fit the idea of hedonism that they thought, you know, they were devil worshippers. You know, but reality was the Indian cultures they encountered were far more advanced as a culture, as a humane culture. In fact, a lot of our founding fathers, when they admit the truth, they based our Congress and all that on Cheyenne and Lakota councils, of chieftains and sub-chiefs and whatever, which was mayors and governors and all of that. And that, all of that was lost. You know, now we attribute that to the Greco-Romans. But it was right here, and it still is here, you know. So let us not forget there's different kinds of evolution. You know, yes, we are technologically advanced. Right now we have a little iPhone that I'm speaking to you right now from. But, you know, the truth is we don't even need this device if we knew how to use our brains completely. I'll be able to have this radio interview with my mind, you know.
Wow.
So the power is there. The power is there. I mean, if you can create a little instrument like this that does receive vibrations through the air and interprets it into sound, why can't you do that with your mind? It's there.
Exactly.
The possibility is there. And there are people who can do it, but we're just not in touch with it because we haven't evolved that part of ourselves, you know.
Right.
We live, you know, most of us by age, I don't know, 15, 16, we get set in our ways and we repeat the same pattern for the rest of our life. And once your life becomes mechanical, you're no longer using your brain the way you should be. I mean, it's just like learning to drive a car. At the beginning, you have to think about the stick shift and all of that, and that's when they had stick shift. And then after a while, you don't think about it. You clutch and you change gears automatically because the brain passes the behavior into the mechanical centers of the brain. And that's
right.
What I always advise people to constantly do things differently. Write with the other hand. Dress differently than you normally do. You know, put your socks on before your pants if you normally put your pants on. Do something different. So you just have to think about your actions. You know, don't be this machine that just feeds
right.
your face, goes about, and does the same 9 to 5 and comes home, hi, honey, take the dog for a walk, you know. And life becomes a pain. You lose the magic. You lose the walking in life, the sacredness of life, which is
That's
at
right.
every given moment, there's magic. There's
yes.
absolute, your very existence is magical.
Exactly.
I mean, right now, for all the listeners, you are listening to my voice through an instrument, and there's you have three little bones in your ear that vibrate, and there's tiny hairs that pick up those vibrations, send the electronic signals to a brain that takes those vibrations and sounds and turns it into comprehensive language.
Yeah.
If that's not amazing, I don't know what it is.
It is.
You know? You have a tongue in your mouth that's a piece of muscle that's so articulate, but just the position where you put your tongue, your accent changes, and you can make these sounds that somehow someone else understands. If that's not magical, I don't know what it is. You have a piece of fat in your eye that reflects the light at the back of your cornea, which is upside down, and your brain has to readjust that to see what you actually... I could go on and on about the human body
yes.
and what a magical, sacred machine it is. But
yes.
how many of us actually respect that when we're eating that McDonald's with the extra fries on the side?
There you go.
That's true. That is true. Jay, it has been a great show. We're down to the last 3 minutes, and I wish we could go an hour longer talking with you today.
Oh, my God. I know.
Do you want to give out your websites one more time?
Well, anyone who wants to contact me, I have 2 pages on Facebook. I have 1 Facebook that... recently was down for 1 or 2 days, and Facebook will send you a message saying he has too many friends, don't come here again. But no. But my other page is called Actor Writer Jay Tavray. You can just press like on it and you can follow all the stuff we just talked about. It's also my page. It's no different. My first one just got filled up so quickly with 5,000-6,000
wow.
people that I got the second one.
Wow.
So, and I can also you know, you can contact me in both of those pages. Although you're not part of it, the page is open. You can still read all the stuff I post, and you can write an email if you want to get a hold of me. Also, you can, if you want to learn about my work, you can go to jtavare.com. That's T-A-V-A-R-E, J-Tavare, or Tavare. Those are the only 2 ways people can say my name, not Tavare or Tavar, you know. And you can also, like, tearsofashaman.com, you can learn more about the musical project I'm doing. And, you know, I hope to see more and more of you people join in. Please follow me on Huffington Post.
And
if you go to Huffington Post and put my name in the box, you can find all the blogs, and I talk about my work. And thank you, both of you, for the opportunity. And
thank you.
I really thank you from the bottom of my heart, as we say in Apache.
Well, you are very welcome to come back on this show anytime. I have thoroughly enjoyed what you've said and shared with everybody today. And, guys, please go and look at his page, add him, follow his work, go to the links for Adopt an Elder, Tears of a Shaman, and get involved.
Yes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your
sacredness.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Have a good evening, everybody, and thanks for joining us on the show.
I'll talk to you later, Karen. I've got to recharge my phone.
Okay.
Okay. Take care.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.